her, I guess, once a Marine, always a Marine. The two Marines who are in her show tonight at Diverse Works should be interesting stuff. Before I get into a conversation with Ira, I'd like to thank people for their concern, their well wishes, their love, as I had eye surgery recently. And thank you for your cards and your emails. That was very touching. And I'm all better, I think. All better. and also, wanted to do a shout out to my Comp 1 class, who I promised I would say hi to, and tell them to remember to stay 15 feet back. Little cryptic message for my Comp 1 class. Ira Zone, are you there? Was there, in fact,
a deliberate deception Hello? Campaign?
Hello? Ira, how are you? Out in California, are you? Where do you live?
Los Angeles.
And why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your travels and what you do, I guess, for a living?
Sort of. I travel regularly to China, to its largest cities, and there I lecture... in two different ways. I lecture for various programs that are being run by large universities in China's biggest cities. I lecture in management courses, things like managerial economics, marketing strategy, things of that sort. My favorite being business ethics. The Chinese find that amusing too. But I also travel to a number of places in China under the auspices of the Beijing Communist Party School. And there I give lectures on, I guess you could call it geopolitics, economic development, political development of China, East Asia, things of that sort. And in just a few days, at the end of this month, I'll be giving a lecture on globalization from a Marxist perspective at Peking University.
And I found your material on LA Sound Posse, the LASoundPosse.com. If the KPFT community wants to check you out, I think you might have some lectures there. Now, we want to talk about art and class today, and I know that's a pretty wide open discussion, but I think you can pick up with your particular perspective on class and art with regards to the issue of art being bourgeois.
Well, not all art should be categorized that way. I think an interesting way of beginning the discussion is with the idea put forward by Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, about 200 years ago. He said there were basically two kinds of knowledge or endeavor. There was practical knowledge, and it's obvious what that would be. And then there's this other kind that involved things like morality and art. And his idea was that those kinds of knowledge, the non-practical kind, had no particular use. They just sort of reflected universally accepted truths. And so there was no point in looking at the social origins of something like art. It was just sort of there, maybe wired into us, as contemporary neuroscientists might say. And indeed, that poses quite a challenge to social scientists. After all, what could the content be of a work by Jackson Pollock? Let's say an abstract expressionist painting. It's not even depicting anything. How could you discuss its social roots? How, if you were a Marxist, could you analyze it from the perspective of historical materialism? And I think that it can be done.
In other words, our environment and our culture, and I guess other and our economics influences our art, perhaps even is a causal agent of art.
Yes, that's what I believe. I'm not the only person believing that. I think it's been accepted in some circles for decades or maybe longer that you just can't get away from the material interest of classes. whether you're talking about a hunting-gathering civilization and its artistic works, or modern civilization and the most abstract works imaginable. If you look carefully enough, you can find the social influences there.
Well, as you talk a little more, I think I've got a question that takes us in a certain direction, but let's open the phones up a little bit and see if people want to talk about this with you. And there is some technical issue with the lines. The technical issue is that sometimes the expert can't hear the question. So we'll ask the callers to keep their comments brief, and you know, if you have a hard time hearing the question, then I can repeat it to you, and we'll try to keep the irritation of that little glitch to a minimum. So the phone number is 713-526-5738. So let's bring this discussion to the issue of the highbrow, lowbrow aspects of art, and what the definitions of those things might be, and how culture influences or forces influence the perspectives of art.
Well, you're referring, of course, to a book that I mentioned in our conversation yesterday called Highbrow, Lowbrow. It's by an eminent social historian, cultural historian, Lawrence Levine. It's published, actually, quite a while ago, 1988. Maybe not so long ago, by Harvard Press, Harvard University Press, and he traces the origin of that distinction. 200 years ago, no one would have thought that there was a certain kind of art that could be called highbrow and a different one called lowbrow. For instance, Shakespeare was extremely popular all over the United States. There was no mining town in America, let's say, in 1850, that didn't have several productions of Shakespeare running at the same time. And these productions invariably were attended by all kinds of people. Maybe some of the better seats were occupied by wealthy people, but most of the people in the audience were not. And the same was true of concerts and other kinds of public performance. The same was true of museums. So if you ask someone, what's elite art and what's not elite art, they would have looked at you with puzzlement at that time. However, an event occurred on May 10th, 1849, at the Astor Place Opera House, a very large theater in Manhattan. Astor Place still exists, but the theater does not. There was a riot there, and the riot involved the way a production of Shakespeare's Macbeth was going to be carried on. Now, that seems bizarre. How could there be a riot over Shakespeare? Isn't Shakespeare sort of neutral? I mean, what conceivable class content could there be to Macbeth? And yet there was, and the reason, as outlined by Professor Levine, is fascinating. Let me just give you the outlines of this riot. Inside the theater, there were about 1,800 people ready to see the performance, and outside there were more than 10,000 people determined that the performance would not go on. And they were lobbing bricks and stones, at the police, who were called out to prevent them from destroying the theater. They wanted to destroy the theater rather than let Shakespeare be performed.
Now, why was that again?
Well, it's very interesting. There were two competing schools of drama at that time. We don't remember them anymore, but some historians do. There was the English school, and the main performer in that vein was a man by the name of William McReady, and he would come to America with his troupe every several years and make a lot of money by performing Shakespeare all over the country.
So it's English actors?
He was an English actor, right. Obviously Scottish descent. And then his counterpart in America was Edwin Forrest. He was regarded as the finest American Shakespearean actor, and they had different acting styles. I guess the Americans was more broad, and perhaps the McReady's was more formal, but it doesn't really matter what the styles were, it's just that they were different. And each had a gigantic following. And the people who followed and championed McReady in this country were wealthy people. And they attended his performances in very large numbers, and the big newspapers gave him very laudatory reviews. And then Forrest was the sort of representative of the working class. And they felt that his style of acting was more democratic and more in tune with their sensibilities. And so every time McReady came to America, he would be denounced by Forrest, and of course had a counter denunciation. McReady said, "Well, you know, I'm the authentic Shakespearean because, after all, you know, I come from Great Britain." And Forrest said, "No, you're not really. You've killed the spirit of Shakespeare. We Americans, we really represent what Shakespeare was all about."
Which side was lobbing the bricks?
Well, the Forrest side, the American side. In other words, aristocrats, very wealthy people, and a lot of poor people were inside, ready to listen to the Englishman give his version of Shakespeare. And the Americans outside were so incensed by the remarks that McReady repeatedly made, ridiculing the American style of drama and kind of ridiculing America, or at least poor America, that they were determined that this performance would not go on. The rivalry was years old, but what really sparked the rage were the revolutions of 1848, which had just been quelled in Europe. There were many revolutions there, uprisings of ordinary people against the feudal regime, the feudal aristocracy, and in many cases the aristocracies were toppled. But they were also trying to overthrow capitalism. In fact, Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto in preparation for the revolutions that everyone knew by the end of 1847 would break out. And in many cases, the revolutionaries were successful in breaking the back of feudalism, but they were not able to overthrow capitalism. The revolutions were brutally crushed, but the event itself resonated in the United States, of course. The Americans followed it very, very carefully. Their society was not that different from the European society. And so the clash of classes was very much what was behind these riots at the Astor Place Opera House.
And so the thinking is that somehow the backwater cousins of the Americans couldn't quite keep up with the Europeans, and then maybe you could say that that the MoMA has been trying to catch up with the Louvre ever since?
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. I'm not that familiar with currents in art, but the feeling was that on the part of the aristocracy, the New York aristocracy, who were of course very wealthy, who championed the Englishman McReady, was that theatrical performances were polluted by the presence of a lot of working class type people. Probably the majority of the people in every theater or every concert, every every public performance, they were ordinary people dressed in ordinary clothing, who brought their manners and their mannerisms to the performance. For instance, if the audience at a Shakespeare play really, really, really liked some soliloquy by an actor, they would demand that he repeat it, sometimes several times. And they would hoot and stamp and cheer for things they liked. And they would throw a lot of vegetables at performers or performances that they didn't like. There was a very kind of egalitarian air to these events, and the wealthy resented it.
You're listening to Arizona on Living Art, KPFT Houston. And Ira, I wanted to ask you in the same vein, then what about the control of the aristocrats and especially maybe what was happening with the high arts in the in the 50s and 60s, especially in New York with Guggenheims and
the notion that there was a higher art and a lower art arose then. Because the after this riot, it was obvious to everyone that there was a class divide in America that was not different from the class divide in Europe, and the rich felt threatened by it. And in the artistic field, the public performance field, they moved in a very interesting way. They raised the prices of tickets for the kinds of theaters that they liked, so that the poor people found it impossible to attend. They imposed dress standards. I mean, you had to wear, really fancy set of clothes just to be admitted. And they established a new kind of decorum in the theater where you had to sit there politely and applaud only at the appropriate moments. You couldn't throw vegetables. You couldn't demand the repeat of an aria in a Mozart opera.
Don't unwrap your candies.
I suppose not. No popcorn. And so the theater, whether it was drama or opera or concerts, it divided into two distinct sections. There were certain theaters reserved basically for the rich and the sedate, and then others were reserved for everyone else. But it wasn't just in terms of venues that there was a divide. There arose the concept that there are certain kinds of art that only the cultivated, the rich, the educated could appreciate. Art such as Shakespeare. Whereas for other people, they would be more partial to low forms of art. And that idea hadn't really existed before around 1850, 1860. In fact, every American family had two books on its bookshelf, even if it had no more. One was the Bible, and the other was the collected works of Shakespeare. And there was no radio, no movies, no TV, no internet then, and so families would sit around in order to entertain themselves at the end of a day and recite Shakespeare. That was not unusual. So what was unusual was the notion that somehow Shakespeare is lofty and other dramatists are not. And this happened across the board in the field of painting, in all the art forms. Now, where did the words highbrow and lowbrow come from? Well, at the sort of the latter half of the 19th century, paleontology really got off the ground, and they were discovering all kinds of skulls and skeletons of human and pre-human species. And one of the big discoveries was of the Neanderthal man, and the skull actually of the typical Neanderthal was a little larger than our skull. However, its forehead sloped a little. Ours is vertical. Our forehead is vertical, or at least Western is vertical. Neanderthals, they sloped a little. And that was supposed to be because their brains were not as big or they weren't configured correctly. So if you had a high brow, it meant that you were fully modern human. And if you had a low brow or a slanting brow, that meant that you were sort of Neanderthal. You were a caveman or you were a lesser being. And you couldn't appreciate the truly spiritual arts. In fact, by the end of the 19th century, the proponents of this theory or this division, highbrow, lowbrow, were saying that art itself was a spiritual experience. It was almost a religious experience. And refined, cultivated people would be able to appreciate it. And, the masses, the unwashed masses, well, what did they know about it? Some people were even suggesting that Shakespeare should not be performed, because it would always invite the lower classes who would interject their own opinions. So there was serious thought given to banning the performance of Shakespeare. You could read him in the sanctity of your own wealthy home or mansion, And that should be enough for you. You wouldn't want the vulgar masses to attend his performances and disrupt them. And this happened just right across the board, even in non-performing arts scenes such as museums. And Mark Twain wrote about it, how it used to be a kind of enjoyable, warm experience to go to a big museum in a big city, but it had become a very formal affair where you were watched over by guards, and you had to dress in a certain way and act in a certain way, and the cultural divide was very well established by the end of the 19th century, and it's continued into our own time.
And this cultural divide kind of took shape in New York with influential families like the Rockefellers.
Yeah, well, they realized instinctively that they had better control art. They had better try to establish what real art was. And it's no accident that the Museum of Modern Art was set up by the Rockefellers and their friends, the Guggenheims, who were also big industrialists. In fact, the initial exhibits in the Museum of Modern Art really were just the private collections of Abby Rockefeller, who was Nelson Rockefeller's mother, and then a few of her friends. And it was what they considered to be art that was exhibited there, and if it wasn't exhibited there, it wasn't really modern art. And it went that way in all the museums and opera companies, ballet companies, concerts, you name it, things that the public could attend.
Well, there's a famous story about Diego Rivera that you talk about.
Right. Well, that's very, very well known, and I hope I'm not boring my audience by mentioning it, but it involved Nelson Rockefeller. The Rockefellers were building Rockefeller Center. At that time, it was the early 30s, and the Great Depression was on, and labor was very, very cheap, and so they conceived of a huge business and cultural center right in the middle of Manhattan, and it's there to this day. It was built in record time. I think 6 or 7 years was about it, and gigantic buildings, and one of the centerpieces was the RCA building. Radio was getting big by then, and the Radio Corporation of America wanted an appropriate headquarters, and so the RCA building was constructed. It's about 80, 85 stories tall. There's an elegant restaurant at the top, and it was quite an architectural work. And the supervision of the construction, roughly speaking, was left in the hands of Nelson Rockefeller, who was in his early 30s at that time, and it was his little project to sort of train him in how to manage things. He later, of course, went on to become governor of New York State for several terms in a row, and then vice president under Ford after the disgraced resignations of Agnew and Nixon. But that was much later. And so he, like his mother, was an avid collector of modern art. In fact, he established the field of primitive art. His personal collection of what then was called primitive art became the initial collection of the Museum of Primitive Art. In fact, Alfred Barr Jr., who helped or Nelson's mother establish the Museum of Modern Art, helped Nelson establish the Museum of Primitive Art. And obviously, you could see the guiding hand of the Rockefellers and their class in these fairly sophisticated art forms. They kind of invented modern art in a way, at least in America, and primitive art. Now, he, of course, was familiar with the great Mexican muralists, and in particular Diego Rivera. And so he commissioned Rivera to do a mural in the lobby of the RCA building. And he said to Rivera, okay, well, you just do your thing. Whatever you want to put up there, go ahead and do. And so Rivera did. And he engaged the services of a lot of art students, I believe from NYU. And they were installing this very, very large mural on the ceiling of the lobby of the RCA building. And Rockefeller apparently showed up to see it, or there was quite a hubbub. concerning it because Rivera was a communist. And his mission was to depict the progress of humanity from, I don't know, primitive times to the present. And he basically showed the story of exploitation. I guess the, you know, the conquistadors invading Latin America and conquering it was prominent, you know, given that that he came from Mexico. But in modern times, he showed workers being exploited in factories, and John D. Rockefeller playing bridge with his friends. They were all dressed elegantly. There was even a picture of Lenin somewhere there. And so Rockefeller approached Rivera, and he said, well, look, if this thing were to be displayed in my home, it would be perfectly okay. But it's not my home. This is a public place. Thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people are going to pass through this thing every year, and they're going to see this. And frankly, we don't think it's appropriate. I don't know exactly the language that was used, but you know, you get the idea. And Rivera was adamant. However, it was Rockefeller's building. He could do anything he wanted with it. And he said, well, look, for the moment, let's just plaster it over. So that, you know, the public won't see it. And then sometime in the future, when things are a little more mellow, we can, you know, expose it. Well, the mural was destroyed. It was chipped away deliberately. And I think we still have photos of it as it existed just before it was destroyed. But it just doesn't exist anymore. And so, I mean, you get, you know, the, a clear notion of the class nature of art or the control of art. Now, eventually, when the Museum of Modern Art was established in the 1950s, again, with the personal Rockefeller collection being the basis of it, the chairwoman of the board of directors, the board of governors, whatever it called itself, was the wife of John D. Rockefeller III, one of Nelson's uncles. And at the end of the 60s, there was a rebellion on the part of the curators. These curators were people who were formally trained in the arts. They'd gone to prestigious schools. They had PhDs. They knew the history of art. And they started complaining to the Rockefellers that they really had no power to determine what was on the walls of the museum. And Mrs. Rockefeller put her foot down. She said, we understand that you're trained in the arts. You know the histories of painting and sculpture and the sort of things that would be displayed at the museum. But we, after all, are the board of directors, and we make the ultimate decisions as to what will be exhibited. And the employees had no choice but to accept, unless they wanted to resign. And I guess they couldn't think of any alternative to this spectacular museum. It's a very large museum, and it has thousands of pieces, some of which are on exhibit, some of which are in the vaults. And there really weren't that many job opportunities in the field of modern art, and so they submitted. Now, why were they so concerned? Well, at the end of the 60s, there was a lot of art being produced. A lot of it critical of one aspect of the United States' foreign policy or another. The Vietnam War was still very much raging, and then, you know, there were
Social unrest.
The war movement, the feminist movement, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement. I mean, just all across the board, the traditional institutions were being challenged, and the people who were the curators were probably young, and you can just imagine what they would like to be exhibited. Maybe some works produced in Cuba, because Cuba had a very vigorous modern art movement. It was, you know, it had a revolutionary thrust to it. It made a lot of comments on society, and the Rockefellers and their friends knew very well what the curators had in mind, and so they put their foot down.
One more question, let me ask you one more question, yeah. Then we have to wrap this segment up.
Okay.
Then what do you make of the irony of the effort by the high arts to draw in the diversity communities?
I'm not familiar with any of its details.
I mean, diversity is not equal poverty. I should preface that. But clearly, you know, they're reaching out to some of the underprivileged communities of color.
Okay. Well, it's a case of the overprivileged trying to co-opt the underprivileged. There's a lot of discontent in this society, especially among the, you know, the most depressed segments of it. The economy is sputtering. It has not really recovered. And there's a lot of resentment toward the Bush administration, but probably toward any administration that would be in existence, because it obviously favors the wealthy and the powerful. And so there are probably stirrings in the ghettos and the barrios of the society of an artistic nature to criticize what's going on. You know, there are aesthetic protests, as it were. And so the ruling class is probably seeking to co-opt the ruled. And now they can't stop them from producing plays or writing poems that are critical of the order, but if they can absorb them into their own system and implant in them the aesthetic norms that they like, perhaps they can head this movement off at the pass, so that some very talented young person who's not wealthy, who might express him or herself in a rebellious way, will simply not. Will receive the training necessary to become a fine dancer or musician or whatever it might be. But along with technique comes a class outlook. And so a promising composer of, let's say, classical music, who might otherwise produce music of a rebellious nature, is not going to be producing that kind of music.
Co-opting, as it were.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the usual method of rule in America has been co-optation. There was a fascinating interview, for instance, with Bob Dylan at the end of the 70s. I think it was Rolling Stones, you know, some magazine like that, and it was conducted in Malibu, in his very, very large house that he just finished building. And the interviewer said, well, Mr. Dylan, when you started your career, you were involved with the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the anti-nuclear movement, nuclear weapon movement, and your songs are pretty angry. But for the last several years, your songs are, you know, ballads and meditations on the meaning of life, things of that sort, but they're not angry. And Dylan said, well, when you're very rich, it's hard to be angry.
Okay, let's stop there. We got a break for our next segment.
let me just say that, you know, when the Soviet Union wanted to crush dissidents, it sent them to Siberia. When the American ruling class does it, it sends them to Malibu, and which is more effective.
Thanks, Sarah.
It stops them speaking by shoving a lot of money in their mouths.
Okay. We're talking to Ira Zohn. If you want to catch his work, check out L.A. Sound Posse. You're the best. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Have a good day. Okay, we'll be right back to talk to Ilya Arce and some Diverse Works art event people. Stay with us. are listening to Living Art with Michael Woodson today, flying solo. And in the studio now we have Elia Arce, who is at Diverse Works. Now, most people listening here know that Diverse Works is located at 1117 East Freeway off North Main and Naylor. So the show is tonight, Elia's show is tonight at Diverse Works. You can call 713-223-8346 or just go to www.diverseworks.org. Welcome, Elia, to Living Art.
Thank you for having us here.
Tell us a little bit about your show tonight.
The show tonight, it's called The Fifth Commandment. And it's a show that I've been thinking about, actually, in developing since even before the war occurred in Iraq. And I, in the last year, have been doing interviews in San Antonio, San Francisco.
The Fifth Commandment.
Yes,
is
thou shalt not kill.
So you've been around San Francisco.
Yeah.
I forget my commandments and the order too. We used to
memorize. Well, actually, thou shalt not kill in the Catholic religion is the fifth commandment. I understand in the Protestant religion it's actually the sixth commandment. Mm. But since I was brought up Catholic, I figured I will keep it at the fifth commandment. I've been doing interviews and also in 29 Palms and here in Houston. And
29 Palms?
29 Palms is in the Mojave Desert, mm-hmm. in California, and that's where one of the biggest marine training bases is located. And so the piece is interdisciplinary piece. There are videos that are companion to some of the interviews that I will be reading and interpreting. There is also Cameron and Greg, who are here with me today to participate also in the performance.
And we've got a question, I guess. There's a lot to your show. You're a longstanding performing artist and artist of social issues, but I guess you brought to the city today, certainly to the station here, the provocative question, when is it okay to kill?
I've been asking myself that question because I feel like I had a different position before. I'm from Costa Rica, and I, during the late 70s, early 80s, I was there during the invasions that the U.S. did in Nicaragua and El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. So that kind of informed me.
That's
about,
your consciousness.
You know,
some people think of America, they think of hot dogs and apple pie, and you think of troops that are sort of shaping world politics.
Yeah, I thought I was very scared of the U.S. military. I had a very strong physical reaction to the U.S. flag, for example. And so I wanted to challenge myself and face that fear.
Probably by design, huh? I mean, that fear is probably, you know, something that some politicians don't mind other countries getting. They may want you to, you know.
That's true.
You may think, an American may think, well, why, you know, it's not really necessary. You don't have to fear the Stars and Stripes.
Exactly. And I just thought that if I could face that fear, that would make me a stronger person, and it would also, make my position be more valid also against the U.S., you know, foreign policies.
Well, an interesting project. Then you talk to soldiers. You're going right to the source with your fears.
Yeah, I thought if I was able to meet these people
and
understand.
Marines.
Yes. We keep getting corrected on that because, of course, our ignorance, I think, especially progressive people who have been in the progressive movement for many, many years, I feel that we're very ignorant about the U.S. military. I mean, usually we don't want to know anything in detail about that whole corporation, I guess.
Right. The correction being, I used the word soldier and was told soldiers are for army men and Marines are for...
Marines?
Marines, yeah, to refer to the troop.
Yeah, I think, it'll be good, maybe, Cameron, if you can explain a little bit about the difference, you know?
The difference between soldiers and Marines?
Yes.
Well, you want my personal opinion?
I want
from
your
experience?
Personal opinion from experience well, I mean, and what you guys think about, you know? I mean, you all have your own opinions about the different
I don't really want to military get
factions.
Into the whole, like, differences between branches of the military, but, I mean, they always say that Marines train harder than...
That's right. That was what I wanted to hear. Yes. Yes.
It's pretty much a sibling rivalry between the brother branches because, you know, the Marines go to boot camp for 13 weeks and the Army goes for like 8 and our training is just a little bit more vigorous and, you know, by, you know, SOP, standard operating procedure, Marines are actually the ones who are supposed to break down the doors and first to go in. And it's more of a harder job, so you take pride in that.
That's why the Marine Corps is the only branch of the military service that doesn't need approval from Congress to be initiated or act. That's why it's called the President's Own is what they call the Marine Corps, because he can activate the Marine Corps just by presidential order. He doesn't need an act of Congress to do so, but any other branch of the military needs an act of Congress.
Alia, now you have a fear of the Stars and Stripes and the Marines stand behind the Stars and Stripes. What do you... feel now that you've made friends with these people who can quote such things cognitively that you used to fear?
Yeah, well I think that I started to understand the reasons why people join, and which I feel that in a way are similar to why people join in other situations, which is mainly an economic reason. Young people want to be able to have access to care, to education, security, and they want to have families, and this is a way to do that and a way to go to college. And so I feel that the recruiters know this and they use it in order to get people to sign up.
So they don't get them to sign up by telling them that there's young girls in Costa Rica who are both fearful of the Marines.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they use that tactic as well. I'm not sure. But, I mean, there are many different stories that go along that line, I'm sure.
That's the locker room talk.
That's right. That's the locker room talk.
Now, how do you connect these two burly Marines with your art, and what are they going to do in the performance?
Well, one of the things that I have discovered, I guess, is that because of their training, the ability to focus and be disciplined and be totally present actually on stage is it's very strong, which makes for good performance. So there is, for example, a flag folding ceremony that is part of the performance where we honor people who have lost some, you know, their loved ones in a war, who receives the flag. And that when I saw it, I just thought it was such a beautiful choreography piece, just because that's the way I look at things. So to me, it was a beautiful choreography that I think that they execute beautifully and very moving.
So your Marines are going to perform a flag ceremony. I don't know what I can give away about the show.
No, that's fine. Whatever.
Is that happening?
Yeah, that's going to be happening.
With a kind of irony?
No. Actually, the idea is also to challenge myself and challenge the audience in terms of, especially again for people who are used to going to see artwork, you know, our crowd, progressive people, is to give meaning to something that I feel that it has meaning. And I feel that it will be too easy to make fun of things or to do things with irony. And so whatever it is, actually, the way that I try to work it is that whatever feels that the logical thing will be to make fun of it or to make an irony is actually to take it seriously and do it with belief and presence, and that is moving. Because I also believe in taking back the flag, taking back your own country, and I feel that's empowering, and yeah. Just taking it back, taking back your spirituality. We have the morals, you know. We are acting on our morals.
And that's actually an interesting aspect of Alia's show, is that she didn't necessarily write the show, because it's based upon these interviews that she did. And so if people feel that it has anti-war sentiment, then understand that it's a conclusion that they've arrived upon themselves just based on watching it, and that's based on the experiences mainly of veterans who have been in that environment. So they need to consider and think about why they're feeling that way, and maybe there is more substance to the issues than they know about, and that's why they're walking away from it thinking, oh wow, that show kind of was anti-war. But they have to understand that, you know, she didn't write it. She didn't go into a room and, like, let's see, what can I put here? What can I put here to get this emotion? It was derived from interviews. These are spoken words from people who have served in the military.
And Cameron and Greg, you are both Marines who served in Operation Iraqi Freedom.
Yes.
And what do you have to say about your experiences there?
Well, it's pretty interesting that you say that, because I've been in Australia for the past year with, you know, my family, Vicky, Declan, and Zach, and I haven't done really anything. I can't watch the news no more because, you know, I have friends and stuff like that. And Cameron, I called him up one day. I haven't talked to him for like 2 months, and he told me that one of my friends, Smitty or Smith, got shot 1 week before he was supposed to come back to the States. And it's kind of really emotionally overbearing for me. So, you know, one of the pieces that Elia does in the show is actually from an interview from my friend Matt Howard and I. And she reiterates that, I guess, you know, into theater. And I have the piece here if you want me to read it.
And yes.
Okay. Yes, it's titled I Laughed. But this was not written. This was actually word spoken. At the time, you were in a completely different mentality. I laughed, you know? That is one of the hardest things I have in myself right now. I keep talking to my friends about it. You're a completely different person over there. And how horrific does it sound? But when you're over there, it's just so different. If I would have thought what I think now, I would have destroyed myself. You have to be conditioned. You have to condition yourself. But no training that you get can help you prepare for that. Because what do you do for training? You know, you do push-ups, pull-ups, three-mile runs. We get yelled at. We have to clean things. But you can't handle someone sitting down, crying, bleeding, losing life, and begging for help. And then you got someone else there in charge of you, yelling at you just to leave them alone. I mean, there's no training to condition you for that. You can't be conditioned for the bloodlust that you see on these people that you thought were your friends, or worse, the people that are your friends. And you just see the look in their eyes, and you hear their mentality. And honestly, they're just out to kill. And it's like a game. It's like a video game. They're boys playing with toys. But their toys kill people. They are tanks and machine guns. And it's like, wow, look how many people I just killed, you know? And people honestly cared about getting their kills in. People were all actually bragging about it. And you get to this point where you're bragging about it. Like, if you shoot a person and they jump up, you try to hit them in the air, and, you know, it sounds so inhumane. But when you're there, it's like, you know, it's really terrible. And you don't think about it while it's happening. But when you're sitting there in a fighting hole and you can't sleep, and it's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and you're just watching what looks like shooting stars, but in all actuality is artillery and mortar rounds, you just, you know, take a pause and think, what have I done? And what am I part of? You really don't have to kill anybody to be a killer. You could be a killer in your own mind. You don't necessarily have to take part of anything. Sometimes the most devastating thing you could do is nothing. And I said that, and I do believe that, because I was one of the more senior Marines in my platoon, and people would come to my room And I bought a charcoal grill, and I used to always have all these, like, you know, get-togethers and stuff like that. And obviously, you know, when, you know, men get together, especially military, that we tend to have a couple of drinks. And, you know, once your subconscious is talking, because the alcohol, you know, drowns out the consciousness, you hear these people talking. And I'd have, you know, grown men, you know, covered in tattoos and, you know, able to bench like 300 pounds, like, you know, crying in my arms. And one of the guys, he's actually just so sad because he feels disappointed that he actually didn't do nothing. He feels that he went there, just sat around and watched everything happening and didn't do nothing. So he feels like less of a man. And it's just really awful, you know. And like I said, I haven't really dealt with anything because I've been, you know, in Australia just trying to, you know, be with my family. And I don't watch the news no more. I can't watch it. I talked to Cameron 2 days ago on June 9th. There was a car bombing. You know, people in the States, you know, it's just, they, you know, oh, another car bomb. It's just like, you know, you see it so much, you get desensitized. You know, now that, you know, that we haven't been attacked for a while, no one cares no more. And it's pretty much not an issue unless you have a family member over there. But and the ironic part is that I actually saw a car bombing, but then when Cameron told me that it was Daniel Chavez, it really struck hard to home, because I was with him for 4 months, and my fiance Vicky is over there in Australia, and we was on guard, and I used to use his phone to call her. And so I'd always joke around with him, and we really developed a friendship. And, you know, we call him Boots because they're just so fresh from boot camp. And, you know, he was my boot. I used to call him my boot, and I messed around with him, picked on him. You know, we'd goof around on guard and make, you know, MRE bombs. You put water and add heat, and you throw it into like a bottle and add water and shake it up, and it explodes and scares the crap out of everybody. And it's really funny. And, you know, yeah, you know, but just to think that, you know, this awesome little guy, I mean, he's just, you know, how old is he, Cam? 19?
He's 20.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he had a birthday, yeah. Obviously, I've been gone for a year. And, you know, I want to call his family and just let them know, but I don't even think they speak English. And, you know, it's just, it's devastating. So how do I feel about it? With extreme hate and fear and confusion, because some part of me wants to feel pride, you know, because Saddam is gone. But, I mean, is the country any better? I doubt it. You know, these people, these civilians are the ones living in fear. You know, and you hear about all these people attacking everyone and stuff like that, but it's just a few radicals, you know. It's obviously the news grabs at straws and changes everything around, so it sells. So I feel very, very against the war, and I feel a lot of hatred.
Yeah, I feel a lot of anger, too, because you have, you know, men and women who are in their 20s, and, they, you know, I feel that they still haven't experienced the best years of their lives, and they're sent to fight for this cause that truly, I don't believe that they understand what they're actually over there for. I mean, they have this idea that's been told to them, but it's really frustrating with the fact that, yeah, these young men and women, and then on the other side of the spectrum, you have the citizens of Iraq who are getting caught in the middle of this battle, and a lot of them are, you know, children who are dying, and they don't even understand what's going on, and they don't know why they should be afraid of, you know, these men around them. But I think mainly right now that I feel a lot of anger and frustration with this country. And don't get me wrong, because I love this country, but this is a country that has now supported a regime that took them to war based on false information and continued to support the administration as they used fear, lies, and deceit to push their imperialistic agenda upon the rest of the world. And we as a country have allowed this to happen, and, you know, it still seems like we do nothing about it. And I know that there are those of us who protest and we speak out and we try and do our small part, but unfortunately the minority does not speak for the overall sentiment of this country. And as long as we have clothes on our back or food on the table, satellite television, and all our materials, like amenities, we really don't seem to care about what goes on. Is if it's not in our backyard, we really don't care. And as long as we don't have to see it, we feel it doesn't affect our lives. They say ignorance is bliss, and the best slave is the one who thinks he's free. And I have to agree with the people who say that this country is heading in the wrong direction, because we have to hold ourselves accountable, because ultimately we as a people control this government. And we can change it. We have the power to change it. We've seen it in many countries that the people have the power to change things when they're not the way that they should be. And whether that means to elect different officials or what, you know, I don't know. I think that's still to be discovered. But we have to do it soon, or I think it's going to be too late. Eventually we'll fall as all empires fall.
And you get a chance to do that tonight at Diverse Works. Elia Arce's the Fifth Commandment, and we thank you all for coming in today. Elia, Greg, Cameron, very important stuff. Very nice.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
And Mike, you have a quick calendar event, and we thank you for living. We thank you for listening to Living Art. Michael Woodson, thank Mike McGuire for the board.
Okay. Yeah, just real quick. High Fly at Helios, June 19th, Sunday, is music and poetry, hosted by Nuestra Palabra and Carla Aguilar.
Okay.
Some of the featured people, Jerome Washington Coolby.
It was a good show today. Thank you for listening to awesome. Living Art.
Afflicted from Technology Bytes, and on Friday, July the 8th, around 7:30, Technology Bytes is going to be having a 10th year anniversary party to celebrate 10 years of Technology Bytes being on KPFT 90.1 FM. Where's this happening? 912 Prairie downtown, that's Kava Kane's Coffee House. And you know things are going to get a little crazy. It is the guys from Tech Bytes, after all, and we want to rock and roll. Geeks Gone Wild. There's going to be giveaways. The band Drop Trio is going to be playing. What more really could you want? GeekRadio.com or TechnologyBytes.com for more info. Oh, yeah, that's great. Upstaged by a computer voice.
Hi there, I'm Mr. V.
Hi, I'm Mrs. V. If you enjoy a little down-home humor with your down-home blues, join us here Sunday mornings.
That's from 8 to 11, Blues on the Move, where you can hear me push Miss V's butt.
Miss who?
Miss V.
Yeah, right. I can't feel it when you push it.
Oh, baby, I can push it hard. So join us Sunday morning. That's from 8 to 11 right here on KPFT, 90.1 FM, Pacifica Radio, and 89.5 in Galveston, Texas.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Talks are continuing behind the scenes at the European Union summit in Brussels to try to end a deadlock over the budget. The Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, has said it is unlikely that a deal could be reached. The deadlock is rooted in fundamental disagreement between France and Britain, variously supported by other members. From Brussels, Johnny Diamond sent this report.
After a day of deadlock, it looks as if the summit hosts, the Luxembourg government, are going to make one last effort to get a deal on the budget. A new proposal will be put to the British government in the next few hours. But there's very little optimism in the air. Returning to the Council of Ministers building after a short break, the Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi said that he did not believe that a deal could be reached. Nearly everyone wants Britain to yield over its budget rebate. There is some support for the British proposal to link the rebate to cuts in agricultural expenditure. But the EU's two biggest players, France and Germany, are not in favour of reform. Prospects for a deal look poor.
Voting has been extended by 2 hours in the Iranian presidential election, following reports of a high turnout. The election was expected to be the closest since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. There are seven candidates, including the former president, Akhmar Hashemi Rafsanjani. Pam O'Toole reports. Iranian officials say the extension's due to a massive turnout. But in fact, it's not unusual for voting to be extended in such elections. The clerical establishment wants to encourage people to vote, regarding a large turnout as an endorsement of Iran's Islamic system of government. Nevertheless, polling stations in many areas have been busy. Iranian television's shown long queues of people waiting to vote. Earlier, unofficial opinion polls suggested that former President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani was the most popular candidate, followed by the main reformist Mustafa Moin and hardline conservative turned technocrat Mohamed Bagar Kalibaf.
A Ugandan-born bishop has been named as the new Archbishop of York, the second highest office in the Church of England. He's the current bishop for Birmingham, John Sentamu, who becomes the country's first black archbishop. Speaking after his appointment, Bishop Sentamu said it was imperative that the church recover its vision and confidence. Asked about the contentious issue of homosexual clergy,